Recording in Los Gatos, California on March 29th, 2016. This is Geek Speak, episode 9 of our 16th season. You're listening to Independent Public Radio 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz and streaming live worldwide at KOSP.org. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP or any of the geeks' affiliated organizations. I'm Lyle Troxell, your host and producer of Geek Speak, and with me in the studio is Mr. Miles Elund. He's a software engineer and political junkie. Hey, Miles.
Hey.
Thanks for joining me.
Always a pleasure.
It's kind of exciting, isn't it?
What is exciting? I'm sorry.
That Mr. Al Lucco, a Bay Area man.
Oh, Al, oh, I didn't see you. Oh, man. Hey, how's it going?
I've been here this whole time.
Area man and new media architect. It's been a while, Al. It's like a long time, right?
Yeah, it's been a while.
Too long.
Well, it's welcome. It's been probably a year more. Ooh. Something.
What have you been doing with your time?
Well, you know, I'm a startup guy.
You are.
And the startup I was in got acquired.
You're no longer a startup guy.
So now I'm part of, you know, I'm now a cog, an official cog. So I'm part of a bigger, larger organization.
So Miles can talk about anything he wants because he's not employed. Mm-hmm. I work for Netflix, so I have to be careful to some degree. What behemoth do you work for?
I work for Sleep Number, Select Comfort. They bought the company, the startup I was in, called BAM Labs.
Which I think we talked about on the show before.
We might have mentioned it, you know. And I was doing that for a long time and, you know, now I'm part of this larger thing, and it was a really good synergy. It was the right product. I mean,
that's cool.
You know, so everything worked out. And now I'm
a new stage, no longer a startup guy.
A little more security.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, it's always good.
Yeah.
All right, and I could ask about your kids and all that, but then I'm like being fictitious because I know weird about this about you. I talk to you all the time.
I know.
Anyway, let's move on though. Let's talk about some interesting maybe books you're reading or something.
Yeah, an interesting thing that I ran across, and it's a comic book, and it's called Modern Palaxis. And it's got what they call augmented reality, which I'm sure a lot of people out here know about. But the cool thing about it is it's a regular comic.
Wait, is it a comic book about augmented reality?
No.
Okay.
The comic book is actually about this guy, I guess his name is Modern Palaxis, and he's a paranoid time traveler. And it's really sort of a journal. So you look at it, and it's got, you know, pictures in it and handwriting, and it looks like it kind of a journal. But it also comes with this app. And the app, when you pick it up and you hold it, you know, it accesses your camera, and you hold it in front of the page, the entire book becomes a new experience because it's no longer just what you're seeing, but there's a whole nother layer on there. As well as not only just a layer, but let me see if I can do this. They also have music. So when you go over a page, it'll like have you can probably kind of hear that.
Yeah, kind of hear it. So
this is great for radio, by the way.
What you're doing basically is you're just like when you're going to take a picture with your phone, your camera's display, your screen shows up whatever's on the camera.
Right.
And you aim this camera at this book, which is a cool illustrated book. Looks hand-drawn, a lot of cool handwritten fonts and such. A lot of drawing. It looks kind of like a composition book from a science class.
Right.
Yeah, that kind of thing.
And so you put it in front of it, and then it will change what you're seeing to be the real story because the guy wrote his journal, but then I didn't really mean that, you know, and you put it, and it's a whole nother layer.
And it's augmented. So
it's augmented,
through the video camera of the phone, you see the book, but the overlaying the book is this extra art and text and sound and actual video kind of moving along. Mm-hmm. And it really does look like it enhances the book.
It's
and what you're
amazing.
Saying is that the narrative is that through the phone, through the augmented reality, you can actually see the real meaning of the author, not what the book
is.
So it's if you read it without the app, you don't get as much depth.
Well,
in the
book. It's a cool take on comics. It was originally a Kickstarter project. The guy he built the whole book. He had 139 backers, raised about $11,000.
Not bad
to create the book. And I think you know it's the kind of thing that once you look at it, you're like, boy, this is a new dimension in comics. I mean, comics have been around, and I like comics, and who doesn't? I mean,
they're awesome.
Yeah, but it's a whole nother level of comic that I think our listeners would probably enjoy.
Absolutely. You know, this reminded me, as soon as you showed me this, which it really is kind of amazing, and it does show this example of augmented reality in that you're still dealing with a physical object, but more content is added to it, augmented. Yeah. My friend and a former student of mine, Jacob Garby, is working on his PhD now at UCSC under some really amazing people in the games department. And his thesis project for Digital Art New Media, the program I used to run at UCSC, was this, but in poster form. So he had these large printed out posters around the wall, and they had stories about, I can't recall the actual narrative, but they're really pretty pictures with butterflies and all that. Right. And if you had the app on your phone, you'd come up over it and more text and more information would show up on your phone based off those images. So this, and I think he graduated in, or he graduated in 2012. So this kind of tech's been around for a while, but to see it in such a pretty wrapped up package is really cool.
And it works not just with the book, but I mean, if anywhere the images, I mean, I went to his website and I looked at his images on the website and held the app up in front of the website just to, you know, see if I could do it. And it worked. So I'm looking at, you know, moving clouds and music and all that stuff on my phone. The guy's name is, he only goes by Sutu. But he did this with did all the illustration and everything himself. The programming was by a guy named Lukaszek Karlok, and the music was by Lahasa Menkur.
And you can find the Kickstarter. You can still buy the book, I'm assuming.
You can buy the book now. The guys in Australia, I found it. You'd look up modernpalaxis.com, and that'll be a link on our site. But the guys in Australia, when I ordered the book, it just came in like somebody like put it in an envelope and wrote my name. You know, it wasn't awesome. Like a, you know, big Invisual. Thing. Yeah. You know, it's like somebody's like selling the book. The guy who made the book sold the book.
Hey, after the show, let's pull out your phone and do some of the work, and I'll videotape that and we'll put it up on a Geek Space.
Okay, that's a good idea.
What it looks like. Yeah. Cool. Mm-hmm. Very cool. All right, Miles, since we're talking about new agey stuff or new science stuff, let's talk about NASA.
NASA has had a bit of a checkered history. They're or at least according to the former director of NASA.
They put a lot of checkers on their rockets, too. If you look at the bottom of
and it's
checkered history.
It's because it's this former chief of NASA that people have started to take notice, which is basically saying that the U.S. has no space policy, no vision, no plan, no budget is the quote. And the idea being that, yes, President Obama has said we should go to Mars. And President Bush before him said we should make a lunar base. And yet the budget that's afforded to NASA is not even close to what is necessary for these actions.
Right.
And with every Congress that goes by, the budget and priorities change due to outsourcing or rather this particular state needs to get the bid for building this particular part and whatnot, which isn't necessarily in line with when you're going to actually launch rockets and get them to their required destination. One thing comes to mind is a state that had a NASA hangar, a huge hangar for building and housing large mobile bases, so rockets and planes and stuff like that,
like a space industry kind of thing,
right?
Yeah,
and when it was finished, it was immediately mothballed because it was never planned on being used. Mm-hmm. They had already decided that they weren't going to have it part of the budget to them to use
to
it, but it was part of the budget for building, and a lot of jobs were.
I referenced UCSC before, and when I worked there, it was very common to get one-time funds that you could do things with. So you get this funds like, oh, wow, we could do a whole lab of this kind of quality. Fast forward a year later, there's no maintainability, there's no staffing, and you just have this kind of lab that's not being used. Like, that's a constant thing in government.
And usually, like, almost half-finished most of the way there, but that last part would take money and you just don't have it, which means that everything just languishes.
Fully finished. You know, as tech goes, 2 or 3 years later, all that stuff's obsolete. Like you can't do something like that without a maintainable budget. And so, I guess because you don't see a lot of movement in space exploration, if you will, you kind of can assume that. Except that in the commercial space, it is moving forward, right? We do have some success.
This is a nice change, is because a lot of those things that NASA was contracting to do, the short flights to put up satellites and like, although we lost a lot of our capability with the loss of the space shuttles, and so we were outsourcing off to Russian Federation and other places, where now NASA can focus on what NASA should be doing best, which is pushing that limit where you don't know what the reward is going to be. It's those things that large expenditures of money, pooling resources from government is the only way you can really do them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, would we have gotten to the moon if it hadn't been for a huge government push to do
so? We haven't done it since.
Well, the Russians did throw up that satellite, and that kind of spurred on Sputnik.
We need a nemesis, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We need somebody else that's going to try to go to Mars.
Yeah. ISIS, you need to start sending rockets to Mars.
Right.
Please stop killing people.
We'll be there next year.
Yeah. That would be awesome. Terrorists that are like space successful.
Yeah.
Right. And so you do have the private sector taking over a lot of that loading now. They're,
yeah.
And they're poised to do so. But you also need to have that desire to work for the purposes of pure science or pure exploration.
And it is not the same. Having private sector do that makes a lot of sense. But the actual pure research that NASA's been supported for so long is a completely different thing that an individual corporation can't do that level of – maybe Google can.
Well, they do have perhaps the money to do it, mm-hmm. but then they fail on their fiduciary duty, because how do you quantify how much money you're going to make from an endeavor if it has never been done before?
Absolutely, yeah.
And if you're talking about just the quick startup to do something, no problem. But if you're talking about huge hundreds of billions of dollars expenditure to go to the moon or to Mars, then suddenly that's, a company like Apple or Google size, and they're betting everything on this one adventure. Venture hoping that it will pan out and that they will be able to recoup those costs, and that some competitor won't be able to see what they've messed up and do something cheaper.
All right, so augmented reality comics, NASA woes. Let's get something more funny. Should we talk about squirrels?
Apparently, there's a lot of power disruptions in the United States, and oftentimes we don't really know why they're caused. Power's out and then power comes back on.
It happens all the time.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who speculate. There's been a meme around that there's a cyber war going on and all this stuff's happening.
And that's true, right?
Skynet is taking over and just testing us.
Actually, there's been zero interruptions from foreign governments and our power that we can detect. Well, it turns out it's oftentimes animals, and more often than not, squirrels. So a guy put this site together.
Sorry, imagine a squirrel climbing the telephone pole and pulling a switch.
Yeah.
No, this is not okay with
that. That explains my Comcast connection every morning.
It's usually the last thing the squirrel ever does when they disrupt power.
It's a terminal interruption.
Yes. Mm. And this guy, I've been trying to find his name. He's an East Coast resident. He likes to be called Cyber Squirrel. That's what his Twitter thing is and everything.
Awesome.
And he's built a map that shows the hundreds of power disruptions caused by squirrels. It's very cool.
Now that is some, wait for it, fuzzy logic.
Yeah.
You can edit that out.
Anyway. So it happens a lot. And then the guy has expanded now. He's got reports of other creatures. There's a
I want to know what kind of where's the
– Well, for 2016, he had 671 squirrel power outages, 255 birds, 54 raccoons, 48 snake, 28 rat, and Martin apparently has its own category of 12.
What's a Martin? An animal?
I think it's an animal.
It's
an animal, but it's
not a dude named Martin.
I don't think it's a purple Martin. I think it's like a little rodent or something.
So squirrels definitely top the list.
Squirrels are definitely the ones that really they cut in 2015. Squirrels caused 560 outages in Montana.
Okay, why don't we design the infrastructure to handle squirrels? What is it about power transmission that a squirrel is just not a good?
Don't you mean why don't we bury our power lines like they do in the East so that?
Actually, this map is a lot of the East Coast, too.
Oh,
I think part of this is that squirrels actually get into cupboards and they get into things, too.
Yeah. I mean, they're hiding stuff. They're touching two things at the same time.
Yeah.
That, they can be on one side and then the other side, but if they're
leaping
and they touch both.
You're saying that they make an arc, which makes an arc?
Yes. They're arcing. But there's so many. There's so many animals.
I feel like I have a whole theme going on here. I'm going to bring up UCSC again.
Yeah.
There's three stories, three times I mentioned it. Yeah, this was definitely a problem. But it was never outside on transformers and stuff. It was always inside closets. They'd break into old buildings and they'd make little nests.
Right.
And they'd happen to touch two connectors inside of a transmission
box.
A
lot of your power outages, that's
squirrels. So where do we find the squirrel map?
It's at cybersquirrel.com,
believe. Oh, good. I'm so glad. I think we're going to just stop in the show now and go look at that for a while.
No, okay.
Sad.
Yeah, you just and it'll show you the map, and then you tap on it. Like I just tapped on one, and it says event June 17th, 2015, raccoon shorts out power supply, and then it links to the article, and then there's like article. I mean, people write articles about this.
Full interactive narrative about it. It's wonderful.
Raccoon shorts out power supply.
Times they ever survive? It'd be fascinating.
I don't think they.
Well, speaking of rodents, what's up with Disney? Thanks, Al.
So this Disney's been in the news lately, because they were having a bunch of people train overseas employees to take their jobs. Basically, told if they didn't.
You mean U.S. employees were told to train people
long-term
overseas.
U.S. employees? Yeah, we're told you need to train your replacements who are overseas that are cheaper than you, and if you don't agree to train them, then you don't get any severance. And it's been before Congress, and it's a hot button issue. Well,
it is not a cool thing to do to somebody.
It is not at all.
Well, you don't have to speak English to be in one of those big suits. They never speak or anything. They just.
I don't think it's just in entertainment people at the parks. I think it's probably also staff in general.
Oh,
yeah.
Disney's CEO is doubling down and asking employees to chip in to help pay for their copyright lobbyists.
Wait, so the CEO is asking the employees to like make donations to their probably super fund?
Yes. basically, the heir apparent to the 1998 Copyright Extension Act, which has also been dubbed the Mickey Mouse Protection Act.
Yes, this is the never-ending copyright.
Or the retroactively extending copyright. In other words,
basically, it means it used to be that copyright was set up in such a way that you'd copyright something, and the person that copyrighted actually had rights for a period of time, and after that period of time, it became public domain, enriching our culture, allowing us to reuse and so on.
Yeah, it's changed quite a bit even in the early years of this nation, absolutely. But roughly 27 years.
Yeah, and so since this act, Disney, Mickey is a perfect example of this, it never goes out of copyright.
Steamboat Willie. Yeah,
yeah. Well, yeah, that's the
pre-Mickey, thing
about
this,
is that Mickey Mouse was actually a copyright infringement of Steamboat Willie.
Well, which that then Steamboat they Bill,
bought.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then they bought...
Buster Keaton's character,
and then they bought the rights of that, and so then the corporation owned it. But in any case, a big reason for this dislike of this by a lot of people is that our culture is a remix culture. We whatever we grow up with, we kind of own it as a culture, and if we can't actually reuse it, we're actually limiting ourselves as a society on what is acceptable and not acceptable for expression, and that's the issue with making copyright.
Right. And as we talked about before, when something is under copyright by a company that doesn't feel that they can make any money off of something years later, it may molder and decay and then not be retrievable once copyright theoretically expires.
Right.
It so just so happens in 1998 they had a 20-year retroactive extension. That's probably going to come up again in 2018, which is probably why this is starting up now.
So Disney, of course, doesn't do all their lobbying by their own paycheck. They have a super PAC kind of funding
model. Yeah, Disney PAC, yeah.
And so then they've asked the employees to chip in that. Yeah. If you're a Disney employee, don't chip into that. Mm. Give your money to like organizations that benefit humanity and not benefit a corporation. I mean, come on.
They're very militant about I remember doing a website for Disney Radio in the late 90s. And, you know, probably I would think I was doing the logo part of it and, oh, you should put the ears on there, you know. No, that's a very big, you know, it was like a really long drawn out process to even be able to use a silhouette of the Mickey Mouse ears.
Oh, I bet.
And after a while, it ended up just being called Disney Radio in like sort of a Disney-like font. And it was their property, you know. It just even within their own, you know,
corporation, they couldn't use it.
And I was
it.
Like, oh, you know. And I think at that time they were kind of wondering, what's this World Wide Web thing, and is this something, and is this TV, or you know? So
that's fantastic.
I don't know.
Hey, you're listening to Geek Speak on Independent Public Radio KUSP. I'm Lyle Troxell. With me are Miles Elam and Al Luckow. We're going to chat about fonts in a minute. Stick with us, won't you? We'll be right back. You're listening to Geek Speak on KUSP. I'm Lyle Troxell, speaking with Miles Elam. And Al, you're a designer.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I know about you is that if I ask you about typeface, you regularly know the font. Mm-hmm. And I'm surprised by this. Like, for example, over there on the wall.
It's a curse.
Over there on the wall is a big instructions on how to use like Google Hangouts here at the office. What font is like the join or create a video call? What's the font is that?
Yeah, it looks a lot like Frutiger as a display font on the bold. But the light light part of it. It's, you know, it's probably a Helvetica variant. I would guess that they just sort of.
Sorry, which one are you talking about? Which
he's one, talking about the one on the left there. Yeah. It's not
so
like
all you radio listeners. We're talking about the image on the
can't
left.
Can't you see that?
You know. But in any case, you have a deep understanding of fonts. Yeah. And of course, as a designer, that's one of the crucial things you do, right? Mm-hmm. Is typesetting and such. So let's talk a little bit about fonts. First, let's just lead off with a story that the U.S. government and fonts.
Yeah, I thought it was an interesting thing. There's a font called Clearview, and it may be, you know, some people know what that font is and some people don't. It's a font that's been developed for road signs. And road signs are an interesting kind of a thing. It's not like picking a font for a brochure or a business card or something like that. They have to be able to be seen from a distance. You've got to fit a certain amount of them on in an area. You don't want to hyphenate the word. There's also a lot of things. There's a spread that's caused by the when the light hits the word. If the word is reflective, it's kind of glows. It's very similar to a bleed that you would see in say a newspaper. If you're printing onto a newsprint that's very absorbent, when the text hits the paper, it soaks into the paper.
Oh, and it kind of spreads wider than the design called for.
Yes,
And the effect of that, similar, of course, is kind of get a muddy font. Right. And so can you design a font to make it still work,
right,
even though it does that?
So these fonts that were created for road signs were made in the 60s, and they just weren't really thought out very well.
Was the original font that was used before the Clearview got used?
It was called FHWA Series E Modified.
It sounds like a government name.
Yeah, yeah. It's the Federal Register or Federal Highway Administration. Federal Highway Administration.
It's also called Highway Gothic.
Highway Gothic is another.
I hear Gothic in fonts all the time. What does that mean?
Gothic is referring to a time period. Usually it means sans serif font. I mean, it's bold, you know. But there's a lot. Right now there isn't much.
Wait, Gothic? Yeah. I thought Gothic was the New York Times style.
Well, the Gothic has a lot of meanings. I mean, you can't like say, "Oh, this is." I wouldn't look at a font and say that's Gothic. You know,
Highway,
I might say
Highway
it's Franklin Gothic, but
Highway Gothic is definitely sans serif. Let's talk real quick about what serifs are, just because we're talking about fonts.
Right.
The Times. Everybody knows what New York Times logo looks like, or their text looks like, and they have these. If you think of a T, instead of it just being a straight line on the top and a straight line down, the ends of the top there's like little drops, and they kind of have a curve to them. So there's a little kind of, and that's called a serif.
Right.
And what that does. Is that effectively what's the purpose of having a serif? Like, what's the purpose of having a serif in a font?
Well, a serif is something that helps pull your eye along and helps you read the words. So if you're looking at, you know, like Lyle might be speaking about a lot of the body copy in the Times, the New York Times, if you have a lot of text, which the Times has a lot of text, you would have serifs in the font so that when you're reading it, it's just more comfortable to read because it's a little more.
It gives it line almost.
It just
easier to tell where the line terminates.
Yeah, it draws you along. Whereas if you look at a sans serif font, which is like Helvetica, where there's it's very sharp, you know, and sort of geometric, those are really good for captions because they're smaller groups of text, and it's information that you kind of need to read all of. Like if you're looking at a scientific text. It's a good chance that it's probably sans serif because you kind of need to read all those words. Whereas when you're reading like a story, you just kind of need to glance through it and get the feeling of what they're saying.
What I noticed about a sans serif, with a serif font specifically, if you think of like a lowercase I in a serif font, the bottom of the I, instead of going down straight, actually splays out a bit. Mm-hmm. It kind of has some width to it.
Right.
And what that does is if a lot of the characters, the M and the N, all have this kind of splay at the bottom, it produces a line at the bottom of the above the descenders, whatever that baseline is.
Right.
It produces kind of a line of text, and therefore the text line has its own strength to it, if you will.
Yeah. It's got a structure, and so when you're looking at signage, though, you really need to be able to see this from a distance, and there's also concern now because, you know, we have an aging population, and there's new data that says there's a record spike in the number of drivers over the age of 50, including many over the age of 80. And when you're looking at that, you've got to make sure you have some clean text. And we have this old text.
The Highway Gothic, 1966 or so. And it's kind of everywhere. Mm-hmm. What was the problem with Highway Gothic? What was the problem with this kind of standard?
Well, a lot of the letter forms were very close. Like, you know, the little inside parts of the letters were so tight that when you made a letter out of a reflective material, it would just crash and just, you know, it would seal up those little that light bleed. It's like a halo effect. It just kind of fills in. Like,
can you give us an example? Like, let's talk about the A.
Like, the kind of A that I'm talking about has the little top on it.
Right. Not just a big circle. Right. Not an O with a line to the side, but the one that has
a line above it. That's, you know, the A is going to close up. A B, the little inside parts of the B, if they're too tight, they can actually fill in.
Oh, and then it just looks like a big blob.
Yeah, it's like a blob. And these are the kinds of things that people are seeing. So what happened was an example of what they call design activism.
Okay.
And this has happened in a number of different cases. There's other cases where you might remember a certain problem with ballots a number of years ago.
I recall problems with ballots.
Somebody was like, yeah, you know, those ballots really aren't designed very well.
Dimpled chads and such like that.
Yes. Yeah. And somebody came up with a new design and they proposed that. Another one was the prescription labels are just – they're really poor. Like if you get a prescription at, the pharmacy or something, sure. You're going to look at it. It's like, this is – I got to turn the bottle to read. It's hard to read. It's tiny. And the biggest thing on the label is the logo of – you know, the pharmacy that you're at, which is like the least important thing
absolutely.
For somebody who's trying to find their, you know.
Because all the rest of it is normally just like some sans serif font text.
Right.
Just blah, 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 blah. Maybe some bold, but pretty much just a whole bunch of text.
Right.
So you really have to read the entire thing before you get the knowledge. And you're really looking for like four things. The name of the drug.
Yep.
The what you need to do to take it.
How many times
and
a day.
And, of course, also the Rx number so you can reorder it. Like, there's a few key elements you need to know. Yeah.
And if you look at this woman, Deborah Adler, she proposed a new design, and Target actually picked it up
for their
prescriptions in their pharmacy, and it's beautiful. I mean, it, you know, you look at it, you go, wow, it's a prescription I can read.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what happened with Clearview, and this guy.
One of her designs in Target, of course, is that instead of it being a small, thin, round bottle, it was kind of a flat surface bottle.
Right. They redesigned the bottle,
too. So it's more flat surface. Yeah, really smart. And actually, they also allow a little clipped-on piece of plastic of different colors. So you can take your six pills you're taking, put a different color in each one, and over time, you know the color. You know, that helps out a lot with readability. Okay, so design activism.
Right.
Kind of like, people go, this is bad.
Right.
Let's make this better.
And so it's not commissioned or anything. It's just somebody, you know, doing it. And this guy, Donald Meeker, he designed this typeface along with another graphic designer, Chris O'Hara.
The Clearview typeface. Okay.
And another designer, James Montalbano. I don't want to like miss anybody's name.
Oh, it's probably 100 people.
So there's like three people that put this together. And they just went in and they figured out where all the light traps were and, you know, cleaned up the thing and made a font. And then they sold this font. And the font, you know, I mean, they're selling it. It's not a free thing. It's, you know, like $700, which in the grand scheme of things, if you look at a normal professional font like FF Din or something, it's like $1,500 or you know, I mean, it's an expensive thing.
And when you buy a font, you're buying the right to use that font and basically everything
to reproduce
it. So if the U.S. government, U.S. Transportation Agency or something bought a $700 font, it's not like that's an expense.
It's
whatever,
minimal.
It doesn't matter. Yeah.
So anyhow, it looks like the signs are all going to go back to the old version now.
Well, so wait a second. In the Wikipedia page for Clearview, I see a Clearview highway sign in Farmington Hills, Michigan, installed in 2005. So we've had this newer Clearview font for a while.
Yes.
And I'm assuming that we don't have full coverage of that font. That is probably sometimes you see the older font, sometimes you see a newer font, depending on what stage you're in. Because you're not going to like take down every sign in the country.
No, you don't have to take – they're not going to take them all down. But what they did a study. And they said, well, it's really no better than the old one. And I had to like really dig to find this study. And then I find the study and I realized it was done with 34 licensed drivers. And I'm thinking, well, you know, they did a pretty comprehensive study, you know, a lot of good experiments, but that wasn't really a very good sampling.
No.
And I look at that and I think, oh, so now they're going to go back to this free font, which is just, you know, kind of typed out there.
Yeah.
When people were trying to actually improve this situation – now, you know, we're going to lose that. They're not going to make them take down the signs, but every new sign now is going to be made with this free font.
The FHWA typeface.
Right.
So the FHWA, which was developed in the 1940s, it was designed to work with capital text.
Right.
Almost exclusively.
Right.
And the problem with capital text actually is, well, tell me, what benefits having non-capital text, like capitalized?
Well, you know, capitals have their place, but when you use things that are all capitals, they're a little bit more difficult to read. They're like a display. They're, you know, oftentimes you want to have capitals in something that only uses one or two saccadic movements of your eye. So you look at, it's almost like you're looking at the word as a picture.
Yeah.
And it, you know, but when you have to draw the eye along, you know,
and capitalized kind of makes sense for street signs. Like, yeah, it does make sense. Normally, street signs are street sign. But if you think of, like, the sign I'm looking at here, they have an example, the Clearview side. They have, like, Grand River Avenue, Toledo. And Grand is just abbreviated with GD. Mm-hmm. And it's all upper lowercase, right? Mm-hmm. Normal, how would normal write it. And so Avenue is a very clear distinguishing that Avenue, A-V-E,
right,
really looks like Avenue. I don't have to think about it much. It's got a big capital A.
Yeah.
And so all the words seem to have a little bit more meaning quicker than having it all capitalized.
Right. Capitals are more difficult to get through.
Yeah.
And, you know, if there's nothing worse for a designer than to see somebody out there who's decided that they want to use, like, some script font like Zaf Chancery or, you know, and make everything in all caps.
It's really hard to read.
Almost like motion sickness when you see that.
Yeah,
you're
yeah.
just like, what? You know? So anyway,
So they do a study of 34 people
yeah.
and come up with the conclusion that they're going to go back to the older font. The,
yeah.
The FHWA thing. This isn't saving money. I can't assume this is saving
money.
It's
probably saving $700.
Is that like a yearly license?
It's really not, you know, I kind of feel like, you know,
let's just
make things better. And, you know, when somebody puts time into something to try to improve it, let's just look at it and see, is this an improvement or not? You know, we need more of this kind of thing. More people saying, oh, this is just wrong. You know, these things, I can't read them. Why can't we just fix this thing? Maybe I can try something. You know, we need more of that going on.
The font, there was a decision in 2004 to interim approval of the Clearview font.
Right. It was always interim.
They're rescinding that interim approval.
Right.
So, I don't know, kind of sad. I don't want to see capitalization everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that when you and I are driving around and you see a bad logo, you kind of it upsets you. Mm-hmm. Is the same thing with fonts? I mean, besides the horrible uppercase Zap Chancery usage, do you find like, oh, well, that could be better all the time?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've seen a few things just, I mean, I know there's probably a lot of people listening that are saying, you know, that bugs me too. I just wish I could pick out,
a few things
in my head that have been done recently. There was a logo for the Met that was just redone. That was just...
I was just in Vegas last couple weekends ago, and Treasure Island, the hotel that has the boat battle in
been
the
there,
front.
Yeah.
Yeah, they've rebranded themselves TI. And they have this new logo, and man, they love that logo. I mean, it's fine. The I kind of looks like a person standing. Yeah. The T kind of looks
Do they
looks
sell
like
calculators or anything there?
Because
that would be handy.
All these geeks that were with me were like, what the hell?
Yeah.
But everybody was referring to TI. And that logo, I mean, everywhere. I don't know if I ever saw the word Treasure Island, but TI was everywhere. And it just kind of irked me that it wasn't – it was clearly a decision by a marketing committee, and they went with it. And then they committed.
Yep.
Heavy commitment.
People that need something to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
The Bay Area said, we need our own The OC. TI. That's it.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
Well, so since we've got you as a designer, I want to ask you a question. For years, I've known Adobe's suite of applications. And in fact, a couple weeks ago, we talked about Adobe, and I talked about how I always have it on my machine. I use it all the time. I use Adobe for editing the podcast, the audio suite. But Photoshop's one of these things I pick up all the time. Sometimes I'm good at Illustrator, but most of the time Photoshop, I just land on it because I know how to do stuff in Photoshop. Mm-hmm. But around the Netflix office, we use that as well. But we also the designers also using this thing called Sketch.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of this new thing. It's more of a replacement of Illustrator in the sense that it's all vector-based. But have you used Sketch? Do you know anything about it?
Yep. I've used it because I do a lot of UI design.
Uh-huh.
And there's a lot of talk in the industry right now because Adobe has gone to the subscription model, where you pay a certain amount and you get, you know, you're constantly forever paying for your app.
Adobe Cloud.
Yes. And, you know, I haven't really met anybody that said, I just love the subscription model. At least none of my colleagues have said anything like that.
Well, there's some part of it I like.
Yeah, I mean, you do get free updates, and it keeps going and going and going. But they, you know, their goal is making more money, and that's what it does for them. Well, Sketch represents a new kind of program that's like, you know, we're going to sell this. It's going to be $99. It's going to do this. They've got an extensive community. They've got a lot of resources out there that are that you can download. Sort of an extended plug-in architecture
for doing what kind of things.
Well, like say you need to make a grid really quickly, you can download a plugin. There's another plugin that you can get, and these are all free, by the way. It's kind of similar to like WordPress. You get this other plugin, and say you're designing an app that it's a chat app, and you have a bunch of people, and you want to show it. Well, you just draw all the circles that represent the characters. You select all the circles. You go to this plugin, and you say fill in, and then it goes out to a website and puts people's faces.
Open source.
Open source.
Images in it.
Say you're doing a news app. You select a bunch of, you know, just duplicate a bunch of text, select the text, say fill in with real news, and it just goes in and does
that's
it.
Nice.
So your comps are more real.
One of the features I think is kind of cool, I do mobile development, and designers are constantly like mocking something up, and then they hit a button and actually sync that content to an app on the mobile device, and then can actually paginate and kind of use the app in kind of a skeleton way. Mm-hmm. And it's a pretty useful way of kind of demoing an idea before actually getting someone like me to work on it for 3 months.
Right.
So Sketch, is it comparable to Illustrator? Well, can you put down Illustrator and never buy it?
I actually answered a question on Quora recently about somebody saying, well, I don't know whether I should learn Sketch or Illustrator, you know, people that are new. And, you know, as a guy who's used Illustrator since...
Before it was Illustrator.
Yeah.
I mean, you remember Illustrator too, right?
I used Illustrator 88.
Yeah.
The thing is, and I've used everything, you know, it's not just Illustrator.
You're always trying out new software, that's true.
And I've also used Sketch a lot. Sketch, you know, does a lot of things, but, you know, the bottom line is, and I hate to say it, but, you know, Adobe is big, and they...
they own the space.
They really do, and Illustrator does a lot more than Sketch does. Sketch is really focusing on UI design, and some people are saying, well, we're doing it for everything, we're, you know, well, good, you know, but really, Illustrator has spent, you know, decades honing this application that literally does everything. Sketch doesn't.
What do you think about the learning curve of the two? Like if Miles wanted to, I mean, you know a little bit of Illustrator, right, Miles?
Not very much. I know Inkscape more than
anything else. Right now, if Miles is a capable computer guy, needed to do a whole UI design, would you recommend him doing Illustrator without knowing it?
Well, see, there's the question. A programmer is not necessarily the person to do the UI design.
Okay. So we'll say Fran. You know, Franny over here.
Well, I would say that just if he was doing a UI right now, I think Sketch would be something you could pick up if you were stopping. But, you know, the other thing is just imagine this giant, super huge ocean liner in the ocean. And... it's going a certain direction, and then this little speedboat starts flying around, going the other direction. And everybody's saying, oh, let's go over there. Now the boat realizes, oh, let's go over there. All of a sudden, you know,
right.
It takes a while. But when that thing turns around, it's going to go that way, and you better not be in the way.
So you think
Adobe has a history of just, you know, swallowing up things.
So I get that. At the same time, what I'm seeing with Adobe right now is a lot of work with – multiple little applications. They've got all these iPhone and iPad applications, and I'm opening them and trying them because it's Adobe's name, so I'm going to try it,
right?
And a lot of them are free. And I got to say that I feel lots of times like I'm not sure why they made this app. And that's kind of a frustrating place to be.
Well, Sketch is a great UI app. It's application specific. You're able to get in there, and there's a lot of free resources. You can just go in and copy and paste and put them in there. You can take Bootstrap. You can say, and it's not for just mobile apps, but websites. You can say there's like the entire Bootstrap library. Just copy and paste in there. Very similar to the way you build Bootstrap anyway, when you're doing it.
The theme that I've seen is that Sketch is very much made for if you have a digital output, something that's going to a screen or a website, whereas Illustrator is good for the web and the digital and print
and everything. Yeah.
But the thing, you know, Sketch will allow you to output. You know, you have multiple resolutions for Android. You have multiple resolutions for iOS. It has very good export, utilities. But I've written scripts that do all that in Illustrator.
Right.
So
you can do that
too. I've done it all already. Yeah. And so we can sit there and talk about Illustrator versus Sketch if we want. But already at this point, Adobe has announced they're doing something called Project Comet. and which is due to be released in 2016.
And they're targeting Sketch, basically.
Take thing. One look at it, and yeah. you're like, oh, my God. This. You know, that's basically they took Sketch and they said, well, put 350 people on this project and and make one of these, you know.
Well,
and
we'll so, see. I mean, Adobe's also very good at making bloatware. Like, even though yeah. Photoshop and Illustrator are awesome applications, they right. are complicated and big. And
yep.
everyone knows about Acrobat, mm-hmm. how bad it is. But the other thing to think about is the price, right? I think Adobe yeah. Cloud to get Photoshop is like $25 a month, $29 mm-hmm. a month, something like that. Sketch is $100 forever.
Yep.
Of course, at some point, you're going to need to upgrade the version, so it's not really mm-hmm. that. But, you know, the price comparison has been interesting, except that, of course, Illustrator can do
I could
all of
see,
it,
so. I could see Adobe either just, you know, maybe buying out Sketch just to get them out of the way, like they did with Freehand. You know, they competed with Freehand.
Sure,
and they
sure.
just
Freehand
like,
was a great application.
It was fantastic. Yeah. And that's gone, you know. And, you know, they you know, so all that stuff is going on. And like I say, I still use Sketch. I think it's pretty cool. The other thing that nobody's ever talked about is Adobe Fireworks. Adobe was killing Fireworks. Mm-hmm. Fireworks was basically Sketch. It still was the most awesome thing to design a UI in. And Adobe has announced they're no longer going to support Fireworks. So it's like you got a big corporation making boneheaded decisions. And so some startup company comes along, builds a better app called Sketch. And I really hope they do well because
yeah,
they've
definitely.
Got a great thing going.
Cool.
And,
well, thanks for the design input, all the font information. The Sketch application. I've been curious about it. Thank you very much for that. We're going to take a quick break, and when we get back, we're going to give you a little bit of an update about self-driving cars. This is GeekSpeak. Stay with us. It's GeekSpeak on 889 KUSP and KUSP.org. I'm Lyle Troxell. I'm speaking with Al Luckow and Mr. Miles Elam. Miles, do you have some information about self-driving cars, I hear?
Yes. We've talked about Google's self-driving car a few times on the show and the fact that it was doing so much better than human drivers.
Yes, at safety.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The drawbacks were, for example, it had a problem where someone was on a single speed bicycle and going back and forth trying to
balance.
And
not putting their foot down.
Right.
Right.
And so the car wouldn't actually make the turn because it wasn't sure that it mm-hmm. was stationary.
Right. So every time the car thought, okay, the bike's not going to move, it'd move a little bit and
right.
the car would stop. And so the bike wouldn't move, the car wouldn't move. And it was like,
well, that's the,
I mean,
the,
that's a good fail point.
That's
right?
the thing about, like, you know, I was leaving taco place the other mm-hmm. day, and it was the Taqueria Vallarta in Felton there.
Sure,
I
sure,
was trying to get, and it's really hard to get in. Somebody's got to let you in.
Sure.
So I'm like waiting there, and then some guy, you know, he's pulling up. He's there's a line of cars, and he looks at me, and I look at him, and he just sort of gives me that, you know, guy nod, you know, which means you can go ahead of me. Just go on.
Sure.
And so then I do my little nod and go. And then I thought, you know, if this was a self-driving car, would it understand guy nods?
Right, no.
I don't think so.
Probably
and
not,
and
no.
I would probably be sitting there for a really long time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know?
Can I ask you, why do you call it a guy nod? Because there's not a lot of emotion in there? You just did it for me. That's great. All right. So
statistically speaking, a woman would say, go ahead. Yeah, you know, wave with
yeah,
her hand.
I don't think you nod at a woman like that, and it's
creepy.
It's weird.
Yeah.
You're like a creep now, you
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
So
yeah. At any rate, Google's safe driving record was marred slightly the other day, which was it struck a bus.
The self-driving car hit a bus?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Tragedy! Okay, no.
Right.
No one
now,
was hurt, I'm assuming.
No one was hurt.
Good.
And to be honest, like the Google self-driving car was going 2 miles an hour and the bus was going 15.
Mm-hmm.
So saying that the Google car hit the bus is a little
yeah.
fungible. At the same time, the human driver didn't interfere because the Google car was trying to get around traffic. And in one lane, people were trying to go straight. And so it was trying to move over a lane so it could get a get a turn
mm-hmm.
in. But there were sandbags on the side of the road. And the Google car saw that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was kind of stopped up a little bit, waiting for traffic to clear up. And so traffic went by. It tried to merge back into the lane. And the bus just came rolling by.
And, wow.
And this is the thing is the driver looked back and goes, oh, there's a bus back there, but I'm sure it'll stop. And I'm sure the software thought the same thing because any reasonable person driving would be that way, except
right.
that if you have experience as a driver, you know that in many areas the
right.
buses just go right on through and you
yeah.
need to get out of their way.
Oh, I see. So what you're saying is that it's not uncommon for a bus to do what that bus did.
Yeah. Oh, not at all. And
so
people have learned actually to be gun shy around buses a lot of times.
At the same time, shouldn't the self-driving car know that about the area that it's in?
Well, that's one of the things they're going to be learning
now.
Yeah.
Know now.
But on the bright side, you know, the self-driving car was going 2 miles an hour. That wasn't exactly a breakneck speed or something that's going to cause a huge amount of damage or threat to life. But yeah.
I did see a cartoon the other day where it was a self-driving police car. And he was out giving a ticket to this woman who was also driving in a self-driving car. And he was asking her, "Do you have any idea why my car pulled your car over?"
Eventually, we won't know anything about driving, yeah, that's for like, sure.
Nope.
All right. No other news, though, about self-driving cars?
Just a sad story? Just thinking this brings up the point again of whose insurance pays for it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was kind of curious, like, is the which vehicle is in fault? Is the bus driver in fault or the self-driving car in fault?
The self-driving car was technically at fault.
Because it went into traffic unsafely.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, it did not yield to a bus.
All right. So, Al, you got any new apps or something on your phone to show us?
Well, there is this one called Aria.
Aria. I wanted you to say it first because it's got two I's in there.
Yeah. It reminds me of a name of a character in a book.
Little Mermaid?
No.
That's Ariel.
Is it Ariel?
Yeah. I'm Song of Ice and Fire?
No. Oh, is Aria in
it's not spelled the same way, but...
Yeah, Song of Ice and Fire. Well, thinking the Game of Thrones series.
I'm thinking of The Name of the Wind. Name of the Wind series, there's an Aria in there, which, by the way, I highly recommend that book.
Also an accessibility standard for with regard to websites and applications.
Oh, cool.
Anyway, this it's a little lightweight music player, and it's designed for playing music in your on the road because it basically just shows you a gigantic, you know, play, pause, forward, back button. It's really easy to use in the car. I mean, I don't know why they don't do more apps like this. So many phones are being used in cars. I have when iTunes redesigned their podcast app, they just made all the buttons tinier.
Yeah.
And now it's like, I'm like, how can I use this in my car? I mean, I think half the people listening to podcasts are listening to them in their car, and I can't control I have to put my glasses. I'm not going to put my glasses.
I had a hard time actually learning how to switch the speeds so that the talking speed was at 2x instead of 1x.
Yeah.
And then, of course, like you bump it because
it gets
really
stuck
small.
There, and then you're like,
and then suddenly going at half speed. And you're like, no, that's exactly the opposite of what I wanted.
I know.
This is a 7-hour podcast, for Christ's sake.
It really feels like people, you know, am I the smartest person in the world? Because why don't people just do that? It seems like.
So I have a podcasting app that I love is Overcast. I think it's an amazing app. It's great. It's kind of expensive. I mean, you know, it's free actually now.
Yeah.
But you can give them money if you want. It's made by Marco Arment. And it's a great app, except for the friggin' size of the play button.
Yep.
Anytime in the car, it's like it's not safe to do anything,
right? Right.
And luckily, I've got a skip and a back on my steering wheel. But the actual buttons...
Well, you have a nice
But the
nice
actual buttons on the device are unusable while you're driving. They're just
It'd be nice if they did something like Waze, where you just put your hand over it, just a sensor, and then you just say half speed, double speed, 1.5 speed.
Waze does that?
Yeah, Waze, you put your hand over.
They
have
a gesture control. Yeah.
You put your hand over it, and then you can say, you know, police on the side of the road or car on the shoulder.
That's awesome. Waze is an application that's kind of like a gamification of navigation. So if you're doing a regular commute, you use Waze, and it tells you if there's traffic and all that. And also you can kind of play games with it by routing for it and things of that nature.
Right, but at the idea of going into your phone and trying to type in, I saw police would be horrible. Mm-hmm. So that's why they put in as long as you've touched your hand nearby the phone, it'll go boop, boop.
And then you speak to it. That's cool.
Well, this app is at ariamusic.com, which is a weird spelling. It's A-R-I-I-A music.com. And it represents the type of app that I think is intelligently.
What's its music source? What is it using as its music source?
It only uses your iTunes or your iTunes on your phone. It won't use like Spotify or Pandora or anything.
Okay. That's good. That's
which
good.
Is, you know.
Well, here, I got a little music app recommendation for you guys. And that is if you're using, I've tried the Apple Music and my wife uses Spotify, I think, for music playing. I can't recall. But you know that your Amazon Prime account, if you use Amazon Prime, comes with a free music service? You guys
know
that?
And I just downloaded some songs from there. And unlike the songs where they're in other places. For example, I have the songs that I purchased on iTunes, and I'm able to use AirPlay with that. I have a receiver that does AirPlay.
Sure.
I also have a Google Chromecast, which is something that I can play Pandora or Google Music many other things.
Uh-huh.
And then I get the Amazon app, and I have those songs on there. I can't go to anything. Like, I can't
stream. You mean you can play it from your phone, but you can't AirPlay it. You can't stream it to your Chromecast.
And I can't stream it to my Amazon TV stick either.
Well, that's funny. Can't you? That's really ridiculous. What about your – do you have that one of those Amazon talking cylinders?
No, I don't have an Echo.
I bet it works there. What do you got there, Al?
That's a visualizer for the iPad I'm showing right now. It's you're familiar with the visualizer in iTunes where it's beautiful like things that go to the movement.
iTunes visual stuff.
To the music.
Like
there's,
music.
I found a bunch of apps. There's a bunch of apps out there. You just type in visualizer.
Uh-huh.
Then most of them are free, and you can have that
That.
Showing while you're playing the music. And it's got a bunch of different things, you know,
Is that for what app is that for?
That just runs with whatever audio if you're playing
the mic
music
picks up.
For
yeah, cool.
whatever.
Yeah, if someone has a recommendation for an app that looks like Cthuga, if you know what I'm talking about as an app, it was
a good old visualizer.
DOS app from way back in the day that you piped in music into your sound card and it did the visualizations. Huh.
Hey, dude, if you write it,
great 320 by 200 resolution.
Hey, if you write it, I'll put it on the App Store for you, man. All right, if you want to hear more about what we're talking about and see the links and all that and the images of the stories we're talking about, please feel free to visit us at geekspeak.org to learn more about what we are chatting about today. All right, I lost our place in the doc, guys. What are we talking about?
We're talking about Library of Congress.
Oh, yeah, let's do that.
For the first time in over 30 years, we're going to have a new librarian of Congress. The current librarian of Congress, who is, I believe, 86 years old, will be stepping down.
What's their role? What is the Library of Congress? I'm assuming it's like a high-end position.
Well, they tell you to be quiet if you're in the Library of Congress.
There is you're charged with the archival of important documents. So with regard to the Constitution, Declaration of Independence, those things, but also anything of note, so any bills that have passed through Congress, that goes in there. Everything that is published within –
from the Congress?
Well, no. Published anywhere.
Anywhere?
Yeah. In general, a copy gets sent to the Library of Congress.
That's a big library.
Yes, it is. It's a huge library. And that's funny because the Library of Congress is now used as a unit of measurement sometimes. They'll talk about network speeds and they'll say, it's like 46 Library of Congresses in 1 second. Yeah. But
I wonder where they store all that stuff. They have some kind of like
in
big,
the library?
Big cave, like underground.
Under
it's
DC?
A super like giant.
Yes, but it also sets many
of the
nations.
Is the Smithsonian a part of the Library of Congress?
No, that's separate.
Well, it is a government organization, but it is not part of the Library of Congress.
All right.
But yeah, they maintain a collection of 160 million works, ranging from Civil War photographs to 15th century Gutenberg Bible, things like that.
That's what I'd want to check out.
Yeah, he's been in office doing the post, I guess now it's less than 30 years, 1987.
How old was he? Does anybody have a calculator? So he was not a young guy when he got.
Well, in general, you're not.
Yeah.
At the same time, it is an interesting statement that that James Billington, who's stepping down, he was part of a group which is for the last 40 years or 43 years did not have a training as a librarian.
Hmm. Oh, really? How do you get the post?
Well, how you get any post.
He
you
knew
can
a
be
guy.
Appointed to
he
it.
Knew a guy. Yeah,
I mean, a lot of times the head of the CIA will not necessarily be somebody who rose to the ranks of the CIA. They'll be a political appointee. Hmm.
So the library does not publicly circulate. Its population is the 535 members of the United States Congress. It has a budget of $600 million. And it has, 160 million items.
Yeah. So let's talk about the
new person coming in.
Well, the person that Obama is recommending for the position, considering the current political climate, who knows if she'll make it in or how long it'll take. But Carla Hayden has been nominated as the next librarian of Congress.
Mm-hmm.
She would be the first professionally trained librarian since 1974 when Lawrence Quincy Mumford retired.
She's actually a librarian. That's
good. As in a PhD.
Wow.
And she's currently the CEO of a large library, the Pratt, the mm-hmm. Enco Pratt for Free Library.
Baltimore, I believe it is. And one of the things that she did was notable for anyway in Baltimore was when there was civil unrest, she was one of the people making sure that the library was a safe place to go so that people could get information about what was going on, a place where they could be secure and safe in their persons, and making sure that there was food and some such, that the library was a safe harbor for person, self, and knowledge.
Yeah, cool. Hmm. And are you endorsing Carla Hayden?
She seems really good in terms of – it's always impressive to me when someone who has a background in the area that they're overseeing
gets
appointed there.
Right, that's always good.
She also has done a great deal of work with regard to tech work, which is something that the Library of Congress has been falling back on. Or has not kept up in pace with in terms of making sure all this stuff is online and readily accessible. The Library of Congress also plays a large role in how copyright law is enforced. They're one of the ones who decides which exemptions are carved out. And having her in there who was a staunch opponent of the Patriot Act back in the day would make a transition there. Mm-hmm. She'd also be the first woman to hold a position and the first African-American to hold a position. So, yes, overall, I'd say I can't think of any downsides.
Hmm. Cool. All right. Well, hey, we will cover one more story about an alternative way of powering a soccer field in just a second. But first, I want to let you know that GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence, is used with permission, and GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. Use our stuff any way you like it. Just let them know the geeks said hi. This is Independent Public Radio, 88.9 KUSP, Santa Cruz, and streaming live worldwide at KUSP.org. To find out more about this or any episode of GeekSpeak, please visit us at GeekSpeak.org. You can also email us and follow Twitter and Facebook and all that. Hey, thanks to our intern Chandler, and to our support geek Greg Merkley, and to Michael Newman of Petstar Music for our theme song, and thank you for joining us for episode 9 of our 16th season. Okay, we got like 45 seconds. What's going on with soccer fields, man?
Well, here's a cool thing. Africa is waking up to the possibilities of renewable energy. And they
Africa, that's very vague.
Well,
we're going to be vague.
I'm getting there. They pledged $20 billion investment over the next decade, and we're talking about Nigeria. And this one university in Lagos, Nigeria, has decided to power their soccer stadium with the footfalls of the players. So the lights are kept on by the players running, and they've been able to use that energy to absorb it and convert it to energy. And I thought that was a pretty interesting way of powering.
That's fantastic. And if the game gets boring, the lights turn off.
Yeah, I guess that's what happens. Yeah.
Thanks, Al. Thanks, Miles. That was fun.
Sure.
Always a pleasure.
See you next week.
My mind is blown. While we were doing the discussion, I was looking at ligatures and just wondering if it would ever came up in the conversation. It didn't, so I didn't bother. But I was looking at the ampersand and the older versions of it. Mm-hmm. Wait a second. That's A-E-T that's been turned into a ligature. Mm-hmm. And
very common.
That's ligature, Latin, French, and.
Oh, is that what
E-T,
it is?
E-T,
That's awesome.
And
you should say that. All right. We're going to move on. If you'd like to interrupt your self-driving car with that information, that would be great. It's your call. I do have it on tape, so maybe I'll add it anyway.